Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode. Hello and welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. This week, we are delighted to be joined by Emma Whitney, who is also known as Emma the Embryologist. Emma is the Director of Embryology and Genetics at the Evewell Group. And as I said, the Emma the Embryologist is her wonderful Instagram account where she tries to make all things embryology accessible and really make it easily digestible for those of us who may not know what that is. But that's why we've got you here today. It's a subject we are keen to address because it is seen as perhaps a little bit behind the scenes, but as Kieran and I both full well know, it is an absolutely vital role in fertility. And that's what we want to do, is really bring that to the fore and increase that conversation. So welcome, Emma.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Thank you for coming. Firstly, if you could kind of give a broad outline as to what embryologists do.
Yeah, so embryologists literally, from the moment you hand over, so we're going to use the phrase gametes quite a lot because gametes to me are eggs and sperm. So from the moment you hand over or they are donated, everything beyond that point to the point where they are put back inside your body lies with an embryologist. The creation, the development, the watching, the grading, the freezing, the thawing, the biopsy, the genetics, all of the bits that involve embryo development lie with one team. And I think there's a real misconception of how it is literally one team. It's a team of embryologists that once all the work is done and your bit is done, and it's the bit that people think is quite scary because they don't understand it. And also it's completely out of your control. And ultimately, a lot of it is out of our control as well. But the bits we can control, we do.
Yeah.
So that's what we do. So nothing is touched by a doctor once they've done their magic and got the eggs to grow, or, you know, if you've produced a sperm sample, once that's got, that's it. It's with an embryology team and that's it.
That is quite a bit of responsibility.
Yeah, definitely.
It takes a long time to find the balance in this job of you very much need to know what you're doing constantly, and it has never left me. I'm 21 years in. So, but there has to be a place where you are able to manage your day to day. When you first start doing embryology, I can't tell you, you just literally shake. You just have to, like, all the training, it's interesting now, this many years into the job, watching the trainees do it, and they're still like vibrating, and you're like, just breathe. And it's something that takes a long time to go, and then once you're in it, there's a real balance between still having ultimate respect for what you're doing, but you ultimately don't want us to be overly emotional and scared because we have a job to do. So yeah,
quite a bit of balance to maintain there. But yeah, I can understand, you know, especially when you first start, is knowing how important what it is what you're doing and how much it means to the people on the other side. You know, like I mentioned, that there is so much responsibility there, and that's why we were so keen to get you on, because often between the patients it's just the doctors they're speaking to, but then, like you're saying, that the doctors are nowhere near all that, and this is where the real magic happens.
So a lot of the reason that I, after being in two very big clinics for the first part of 15, 16 years of my career, I made a move to the Evewell predominantly because of the patient-centered focused care and the fact that the embryologists are such a huge part of your journey. You should, as patients, be able to understand what goes on, and you should be able to meet those people and speak to those people. And it's part of the ethos, is very much about opening that relationship and that dialogue between patients and embryology teams, because we are the experts in the bit between what is ultimately going to make this work or not. We are the experts in, if these embryos don't grow, why don't they grow? Is there an element there? And we are the people that should be having that dialogue. We don't spend 6 years training in university and doing master's degrees, and it's a lengthy old, you know, job to get into. So that was my main focus as I got into my later bit of my career, is now very much about educating patients and trying to break down this fear that is what it is, which is the lab door shuts and nobody can see what's going on. It shouldn't be like that.
Now, it's really interesting, Emma, that you talk about, you know, embryologists being not anxious, but at the beginning of their careers, because of the importance of it. Because I distinctly remember the anxiety about that hatch. Like, as a patient, going there and having this sample in my hand or in a pot and thinking, what happens beyond this? And there was a lot of, I think my anxiety came from like fear of being judged by the person on the other side, because what was in that pot was deeply personal to me and had kind of broken down. My view of myself had broken down because of my infertility issues or my fertility issues. So it's really refreshing to hear that actually what goes behind that hatch, people are, as you said, not emotionally involved. They can't get, but they're as willing for it to work as we need it to work.
I can't tell you the amount of conversations we have beyond, like when patients phone in and say they're pregnant. In our company, it's escalated all the way through an all-staff email. And the relationship we have with knowing that what we did has worked to enable you to have a family, that elation, that joy never goes away. You know, you hand over your sample, and it's what makes me sad is that you said you feel judged. And I'm hoping that landscape is changing, mainly because of people like you, because men, oh my goodness, 20 years ago, men wouldn't even look me in the eye. And now I can sit and have a conversation and be very, very honest about X, Y, and Z, whatever needs to be done. And it's a very much an open conversation and an open dialogue that absolutely should be there. And it helps couples, if couples are going through this, it helps the women feel less alone.
Yeah.
Because it can be a very lonely space otherwise. So there is never any judgment. I think it's, for our perspective, you've got to remember that we have all the stories I could tell. Maybe one day I'll write a book. But we have seen everything. We have seen all sorts of things. And actually, our ultimate end goal is just to help what nature can't do, help it happen in a different way.
Yeah, yeah. I think that judgment comes from, like, personally, from what I kind of reflect on. It was my identity as a man had changed. So I was just fearful that everyone else was going to judge that as well, when actually the biggest judge was me. I was the one judging myself. And that years later now, I can look back and realize that people didn't care what was, they weren't going to judge me. They were there to help me. Yeah, and that's the key. And that's one of the key messages that we're trying to get through, especially with this episode, is the fact that you've said it already. There's a team there ready to help.
Yeah. And I loved what you said, actually, Emma. Because it really does, it makes it human, in that when you said just to help along what nature can't do, and it simplifies what is an extremely emotive and, of course, you know, a very upsetting situation, but to know that you've got that caring team behind, and actually kind of that's something that we wanted to address, because it is so big for men when the first time they go and produce a sample. And actually, I just want to take it back to what Kieran said. I'm really glad that you clarified that the sample was in the pot and not in your hand.
Yeah, I know. That's why I said it.
something would have really gone wrong if that was just knocked on the hatch and was like, can you help me out?
It nearly happened once, didn't it?
Yeah, we covered that. It's, a friend of mine texted me about that episode the other day, actually saying it was hilarious. But yeah, Emma, it'd be really good for us men to understand what goes on behind the hatch when we've gone to give our sample. And certainly in the first place I went to, it was literally a hatch in the room. I put the pot in there, rang a bell. And what surprised me was how quickly I could hear it being taken on the other side. So what's going on the other side of that?
Okay, so not to scaremonger anyone, we are not hovering around the back of that hatch, okay? We're not stood there going, oh, hold on, wait a minute. We're not doing that. We are actually really busy doing other stuff. And I think that always used to freak me out with men. They used to go in the room and they go, are you just going to like wait outside the door? And I'm like, no, I've got a job. So let me give you sort of a breakdown of how it works to me. So I work in a clinic that does about 1,000 cycles a year. So I've gone from a clinic that used to do 3,000 cycles a year. So it's the same process, but on a smaller scale. So I've got a team daily of about 5 embryologists, and we'll all be rotated onto certain aspects of our job. So for example, someone will be upstairs in our clinic, it's up and down, but just because we're in the Harley Street buildings and it's like everyone lives in a basement, if you're an embryologist, we don't see daylight. Someone will be upstairs doing the egg collections. Someone will be rotated on to look after the sperm samples. There will be someone else maybe freezing and thawing embryos. There will be someone else that will be speaking to patients and grading those embryos. There will be someone else that will be rotated on to do, if we do quite a lot of genetic testing, which we'll come on to later. So I suppose for you guys, what happens is the person looking after the sperm that day, their sole responsibility is to make sure that that is handled and processed safely. We do have a bell, we do have a hatch, we're not hovering behind it. And ultimately we're in the lab doing stuff. So if that bell goes off, the responsibility we have is to make sure it's removed as safely as possible and quickly and put on a warming plate so that it stays at a temperature that we can work with it. And then it goes through some stages depending on why you're there. If you're having a sperm freeze, it's done and dusted in about 40, 45 minutes. If you're coming in for active treatment, then we have to process that sperm, because when you ejaculate sperm, if you have sperm into a pot with semen, we have to get rid of the semen. The semen is not welcome at all in an IVF laboratory. The only reason you actually ejaculate into semen is because the vagina is actually incredibly acidic. So the semen is alkaline. So it protects the sperm whilst it's going through the reproductive tract if you were trying to conceive naturally. So we have to get the sperm out of the semen, and there's loads of different ways that we can do that. And again, that comes down to your personal circumstances for being that. If you've got a normalish sperm count, we generally just use some centrifuge, some special chemicals to split it out, and we end up with a pellet at the bottom that we wash into some sperm-friendly fluid, and it sits in an incubator and waits until later that day when we start to create the embryos, okay? If you are a guy with a really low sperm count, we might have to do a few extra steps because we might have to spin it twice just to make sure we've got enough to work with. But ultimately, within about an hour of you producing that sample, it is in the incubator or in the freezer. And the reason it then sits there is because about the same time, if you're having an egg collection on the same day, your partner will be upstairs having an egg collection. The eggs will then come into the lab, and they also go into the incubator, and they're basically held for a few hours. It's a lot to do with timings with embryology. So women are triggered for egg collections at around 36 hours. You guys probably know what I mean by that. They have that big trigger injection. And then actually what we try and do is make embryos at around 40 hours, because that's when the eggs are most at the most mature state for when they would actually ovulate. So we're trying to put it together when nature tells us it should go together. And so that all happens in the morning, and you may have three patients that morning, you may have four. But what I will talk about a little bit is once you hand over your samples, most clinics now have double witnessing. We have electronic tags on the pots that are assigned to you with two people looking at it and a computer. And then everything else we bring into a certain space where we can prepare sperm is also electronically tagged. So you've got multiple elements of witnessing, which allows us to, and to be honest, we process everything one by one anyway, but then it will go into the incubator and it's all tagged and electronically witnessed with two embryologists. So we call it double witnessing, and it makes it incredibly, I mean, touch wood, God forbid, but it's never happened to me. It's incredibly safe.
In terms of the sample, one thing I remember very acutely from all of the times I went was it was saying, oh, there was something on the form about if you spill any, let us know. But it was saying the first part is quite important, or really important. So why is that?
So the way that a man ejaculates, you have, so it's to do with your sperm and your semen come from two different places. Your sperm comes from your testicles at the top of it, called the epididymis space, where it holds itself once it's been produced by your testicles. And then as you ejaculate, the semen comes from your seminiferals, your semen producing, I'm not going to pretend to know all the words because I don't, but that first ejaculated part is where most of the sperm are. And then the semen that comes behind it is almost to clear out the pipe work in the penis and all the tubings around it. So if you miss that first part, there will still be sperm potentially in there, but it's good for us to know, because if that is the reason that the sperm count is low and that's going to affect the onward treatment that we're doing, we'll probably ask you to produce again if you can. Remember, if you can't ever produce again, and because that's a tough thing to be asking someone to do. I always feel really guilty when I have to ask a man to produce again within an hour, and they look at you like they're just crestfallen. If you can, it's great. But if you can't, then we can convert things. So if you're having IVF where we mix the sperm and the eggs together and you have missed some of the sample and we don't have enough, we can convert to ICSI. So we can then utilize different methods to inject sperm into eggs or inseminate the eggs with the sperm. And that's all to do with sperm count and medical history and all of that. There are a few things that I probably should highlight is if you abstain for too long, we will know because it shows up. I have had someone that was so embarrassed they tried to lie about how long they'd abstained for, and it had actually been a month, not 3 days. And there was, it is very obvious to us. It's like we know. And actually, again, I think this comes back to your point, Kieran, about embarrassment and all of that. There's no need. There is nothing you can tell me that I haven't heard before. And ultimately, I need to know because then I need to know what I've got to do. If I've got a sample that hasn't been ejaculated, or I've got a man that hasn't ejaculated for a month, I don't want to use that with IVF. I want to make sure that I do my very best to create embryos, and that might mean a change in treatment. So it's really important you communicate that with the embryology team. There's no judgment. We just need to know.
That's really, really interesting. And actually, I wonder, because I remember that as well, is that I think it's 2 to 7 days is the optimum time of abstinence before going to give a sample. And I always, try to go middle, like kind of three and a half or whatever.
So that's actually changed a little bit now. So we can talk about that because I think that would be really good for your listeners to hear too. So actually, if you are on a fertility journey now and you already know that for whatever reason you're having ICSI treatment, which is when we inject the sperm into the eggs, mainly for either previous failed fertilization, I actually use ICSI probably quite a lot more than most places because I don't think you should ever use anyone's first IVF cycle as diagnostic. And if you've got a couple sat in front of you with normal parameters and I'm going to do this unexplained fertility, because unexplained infertility is just a fancy word for we don't know what's wrong. Why on earth would you use their first cycle as diagnostic if you've got 2 years of absolutely no conceptions and a normal parameters everywhere? So I actually, we use ICSI quite a lot. But if you are having ICSI, you do not need to abstain for 2 to 7 days. In fact, from an embryology perspective, I would rather it was 12 hours, 12, 24. The fresher, the better. Ultimately, if your partner gives us 10 eggs, I need 10 sperm. So even if you have a slightly reduced sperm count from the lower abstinence, it's not going to cause me any issues because I need 10 sperm. And actually, the World Health Organization are now dropping it for 2 to 5 days, even for IVF samples.
Okay.
If you are not producing a normal sperm count with 2 days abstinence, then we need to know about that because there is something in that. And I think that for me, I think you can rock up to any fertility clinic and do a sample with just 2 to 3 days abstinence. And also to reiterate what Jonathan Ramsey says over and over again is if you are actively trying to conceive, regardless of where your partner is in their cycle, you should be ejaculating very regularly just to keep everything ticking over. Even if it's not the time of ovulation, you have to.
Yeah, I think that's really, it's interesting what you've just said in terms of the ICSI treatment. But it's also something that we get questioned directly, but people ask all the time. And it comes up in other podcasts, other interviews and stuff. How long should you sustain for? And I remember it was another thing I was anxious about. Is it too long? Is it too short? What's going to happen from it? So to have that little bit of information, hopefully will make it a bit clearer for a few listeners.
I think if anyone's got a really cripplingly low sperm count, and when I talk about cripplingly low, I mean really, really desperately low that we're struggling with, you should be having backup freezing anyway. You should be having something put in place in case on the day there isn't enough to do, you know, the sample. But the abstinence isn't going to change that. Not when you're dealing with counts that low. And actually ticking over, we've shown over the last couple of years a lot with the frequent ejaculation program that Jonathan Ramsey talks about quite a lot. It definitely does encourage better sperm health and sperm turnover.
Well, I guess the factory's getting more work, isn't it? It's just
kind of
becoming smoother.
So
it's better to go shorter than to sustain for longer.
In my mind, from my perspective of doing this for years, like I said, it's not a sperm test. We know what we're doing on the day when you come in. We know exactly what we need to do. And actually, I just need enough to do the job.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what when we did an episode purely dedicated to providing those sperm samples, because it's trying to break down that element of kind of anxiety and embarrassment. Because, you could take this conversation and take it to a normal pub or whatever and say, oh, you're being encouraged to ejaculate more regularly, and it's that whole like male thing of you get a free one, like, well, what, you know, I don't have to do it in secret. But actually, when you then putting it into the context of infertility and fertility treatment, struggling to conceive, it everything changes. And, mm-hmm. and you're already battling against that kind of planned sex, that almost on demand, it's scheduled, I'm ovulating, we need to do it. But if you can try and, I know it's easier said than done, but try and remove that pressure and just try and enjoy it and make it more spontaneous if you can. But that then, like you said, you know, it keeps things ticking over. It's the healthier sperm, easier said than done. And I get it, you know, we've both been there. Is when you're almost being expected to do it every other day, for example, every 3 days, then it does create a bit of a mental block sometimes. But yeah, you're hearing it here.
It's incredibly challenging to speak to men and say, I completely appreciate what I'm asking you to do, but try and remove as much as possible the anxiety of it. And it is just a functional mammalian thing that actually we are made to do. So it makes sense that the more you do it, in obviously with limitations of what's physically possible, the better things are just, like you said, it's a factory. It just
I think it's important for guys to hear as well that if you go to do it and it doesn't work in terms of it's pressure and stress does a lot to the human body. And that's completely normal. I remember distinctly being told you've got to, got to get the factory working more. And some days I couldn't do it because of all the pressure and because of all the stress, because my body wasn't ready for it. But then it worked again another day. It's completely normal. As long as it's not happening regularly.
Yeah. And what I will say is, if you are in that mindset and you are struggling with anxiety and stress, again, we are, I think I can't say this more, we are actually here to help you make sure that this all works, because there is nothing worse for an embryologist than a group of eggs sat in a lab and a man that can't produce a sample.
Yeah.
It is heartbreaking, because it as that day goes on, there's no coming back from that. It's so hard you're in that mindset, right? And once it's failed once and you're on a clock, the pressure and the anxiety of that is just too much for most people. So I will say, if you ever feel that this is all getting a bit overwhelming and you're this whole masturbating on demand and ejaculating on demand is getting too challenging, you need to speak to the embryology team, because what we will suggest you do is freeze a sample.
Yeah.
Because then you've got it in the freezer. This whole misconception that fresh is best, fresh is easier for us. That's all I'm going to say. It's easier because there's just more moving. But that whole misconception that fresh is going to change your outcome is not true. It's frozen sperm, as long as it is alive and moving, works. And if we have to do ICSI, we have to do ICSI. I think this fear around ICSI needs to go as well, because it's an amazing technique. It's one of the best things that's happened in fertility treatment. It's magical. It's very safe. It works really effectively. So if you are struggling with the mindset of ejaculating on the day that your wife is having a procedure, or your partner's having a procedure, or your whatever's happening, donor eggs are being collected, speak to the lab, because they will can freeze a sample and take away that stress a little bit. And then you know that regardless of what happens on the day, you've got something you can use.
Yeah. I certainly, it wasn't on egg collection day, because by that point we were well down the route. We were using donor sperm, but I had a time where I couldn't produce a sample because I had so much anxiety, and I was in the room for 45 minutes. I was like, oh, they're all going to be talking about me. And obviously, you know, as we've discussed, that isn't the case. But I didn't do what your wise advice is to do and speak to the embryology team. I pretty much ran out of the lab and gave an empty pot to the receptionist, and she said, well, it's empty. And I was like, well, yeah. And legged it, and I phoned back up a bit later when I'd calmed down, and then went back and thankfully was able to do it. But it's hard, but I think why we're doing this is to get across that message of communication is key, and that whether that's with your partner at home about fertility in general, and then or with the specialist at the clinic.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're here for. But it's and also I think hand on heart, we've heard it before, and actually it doesn't do anything for us but make us incredibly sad that you feel that way, and we just want to be able to help you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we briefly touched about ICSI, but when I generally thought, when I first started going through our fertility treatments, I thought IVF was ICSI. I didn't have a clue what was going on. I thought it happened to every single sperm. Like,
yeah.
You'd pick it out and put it in. And that's how it was. That was IVF. So I had quite a steep learning curve. And some of it I've learned on this journey that we're doing now. You know, my wife was very heavily involved in knowing what exactly each stage, where I was more concerned about figuring my own head out, I guess, at the time. So in terms of ICSI, what are you looking for with sperm, or what does a healthy sperm look like?
So the two routes to fertilization in the lab, remember the ultimate goal for us with embryos, to make embryos, is we have to get the eggs and the sperm to communicate and fertilize. Ultimately, the bit that comes after that, which maybe we'll talk about in a minute, is the same regardless of whether you have IVF or ICSI. Mm-hmm. Okay. IVF is normally when you've got, there's multiple reasons you do IVF. You do IVF with donor sperm, because if the donor sperm's good, then, and you know why the failure to conceive has not happened on its own, then you could, you know, in certain environments, you can just mix the sperm and the eggs together. It should work. I mean, ultimately, that is what donor sperm's for. Men and women that maybe conceived together before, you can hopefully be reassured that the communication is going to happen. So it requires a normal sperm count. You then put a certain amount of sperm into a dish with the eggs, put them in the incubator, flick on some Barry White, and off you go. That's the aim. But with ICSI, what we call day zero is egg collection day. So day zero to us is egg collection day and sperm production day. Okay, so your eggs come into the lab, and with ICSI, we have to handle them and remove all the outer cells from the eggs, which is called the cumulus cells. So we put it on a microscope, and it is like working on a PlayStation. It's all about hand-eye coordination, and we will pick up one sperm per mature egg, and we use a very, very fine needle to inject the sperm into each egg, and then those eggs go into the incubator, again like the IVF eggs do, but in our clinic they go into time lapse, which is the cameras that are able to see the eggs once they have been injected, or the following day for the IVF fertilized eggs. Once they have fertilized, we put them under a camera. So what we're doing with the ICSI is the sperm's been washed, it's been prepared, it's been sat in the incubator for an hour, 2 hours, and then we're at that 40-hour point where we want to create embryos. We use quite high power, sort of 200, 400 times magnification, to identify the sperm with the best shape in the sample. Now, remember, that's different for everyone. Some people have got perfectly shaped sperm, according to a textbook. Other people we are looking we can spend, I mean, I think the longest ICSIs I've ever done took me 7 hours, because it took me that long to find enough sperm because the sample was so poor. Mm-hmm. But we know that's coming. So that's like, that shouldn't be a shock on the day. That's something that we know we've got to do. So someone will be dedicated to doing that. So we will spend time, depending on the sample, how much time, looking for the best sperm that we can find. And each one of those then gets put in an egg with a needle, and then they're put in the incubator.
It's still baffling to me. Like, it's amazing what you do. Absolutely phenomenal.
ICSI's my favourite thing. I love it.
It's important to make clear that ICSI is generally used for low-quality sperm. And then is IVF used if it's more female-based fertility issues? Or can it work both ways?
Yeah, the landscape's changing, definitely. I mean, there are countries that don't do, like the Middle East countries, Doha, Qatar, Kuwait, Dubai, they don't do IVF at all. Everything is ICSI. I think ICSI was definitely only used for, like, until about 2010-11 when we had to use it. It was sort of seen as this thing of last resort. There was so much fear around it. But now we know so much more about male fertility, DNA frag, and the impact of that, like the unseeing problems that you can't see in a sperm count. A sperm count can look completely normal. There might be an infection. There might be, like I said, I'm sure there's lots of people that can cover this better than me. But we know that ICSI is a route to supporting male fertility problems that you can't see. And I still stand by that if you've got a couple that has been trying to conceive for 2 years of a reasonable reproductive age with normal everything, I am not naive enough to know that I don't know everything. And I'm certainly not going to find out that there's a problem by trying IVF on your first cycle when you've spent £10,000 to do it. I think it's a really, really irresponsible thing to do. ICSI is completely safe. And I think there is definitely a push now to using it more, because in certain circumstances, you will get better embryo development.
Right. Do you think it will become predominantly in the end that's what we will do?
Yeah, I think people are still really. There was a paper released in 2012 about birth defects in ICSI. And I think that's still the only paper that anyone's ever done. And like I said, I go back to that time and think if I bang on my drum and say, but we were using it as the case of last resort in men with such crippling low sperm counts, that maybe we need to stop blaming the ICSI for the outcome of the birth defects and start wondering why the man had such a low sperm count in the first place. Because the chances are there was an underlying genetic problem that we may never be able to identify. But it's not from sticking a needle in an egg.
Yeah.
It's just not.
Do you, are you seeing a change in, for example, in Kieran's case, for example, where they went to the doctors because they were struggling to conceive and only his wife was looked at for a long time. And then it was established he had a very, very low sperm count quite a long time after. Are you seeing a change in that, like where the kind of the male factor is being identified earlier?
No, but I am seeing a change in people's ability to advocate for themselves. And I think that comes from what we sit here and do now. And I think that that is the most important thing. I don't think we are going to be able to change the NHS support route for couples turning up at their GPs. And because ultimately the reason we sit here is so that we can advocate and support these couples with a language that they can go in. I think it's really important that people realise that you can access private semen tests through lots of companies now. There are mail, there's a company called Mojo that will send you a kit out and you can post it and do all of those things that are actually very good at getting you at least a starting point to a semen test if you're being blocked by an NHS route in.
One of our sponsors is Exceed. So,
oh, Exceed, yeah.
It would be remiss of us not to mention it at this point.
Yeah. So Exceed is like, just say Mojo because it's the one I
remember. No,
yeah, so Exceed, yeah, so exactly like that. So there are companies out there that will do those sorts of things, and you can do it from the comfort of your own home. It's all postal. It's like lots of things can be done at home. I would urge anyone to have a proper semen analysis, obviously, because I think it's really important. And as you guys know very well, it's not always clear what's wrong with the sperm just because it looks normal under a microscope on that initial test. But I think what I'm seeing more of is people pushing for what they know they need to have done. And that is definitely coming from not so much from the GPs, from my understanding, because I think that's a battle too big, but I think we can empower people with the right language to use. Lots of clinics are offering fertility reviews now for couples that aren't even thinking about conceiving, so that you can at least get a benchmark to know where you're at when you do, if you do try and conceive. So I think that the landscape is definitely changing to people's understanding and awareness of reproductive health.
It's a positive step in the right direction, and all of those at-home sperm test kits or companies will say that this does not replace a clinical grade test, which is, you know, the right thing to do and say. Because I think you mentioned kind of birth defects and the quality of the sperm not always being picked up. And it's been underestimated, I think, throughout history, just how much impact that sperm health has on embryo development and pregnancy and birth.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely something we're starting to see more in the lab now, is that the understanding of if you get everyone into a very good reproductive space, and that might be nutrition, that might be infection control, that might be DNA frag coming down, that might be lots of things. But I see predominantly more embryos where you have honed in on an undiagnosed male factor infertility. You can completely change people's outcomes.
That's interesting. Do you, you mentioned those obviously ultra powerful microscopes that you use. Is there any tangible difference to what you see between a sample that's being produced in the normal natural way or a sample that's given to you after surgical sperm retrieval?
Yes. So surgical sperm retrievals would be, so there's two ways you can do a surgical sperm retrieval. You can do what's called a PISA or a MISA, which is at the top by the epididymis. So you will have more mature sperm because it's already done its transgression through the testicles into the space that it needs to get to. If you go into the testicles, so there's two, I mean, I suppose the big question here is why are we doing it? Because if it's an obstructive ASU, which is an obstructive azeospermia where there's a blockage in the pipework for something like absence of vas deferens, that's a good example of why we would do it, then you should get if the testicles are functioning properly, you should get a very reasonable sample from a PISA or a MISA or even a testicular biopsy. But if you are dealing with an unobstructive azoospermic, you're sort of going in a bit blind because we can get your hormones and we can kind of understand what's going on with your hormone profile. But you go in and there is most likely a causative factor that is the testicles maybe aren't functioning properly. So Sertoli only cell syndrome or something along the like. So when you are dealing with that, yes, you tend to be dealing on, from my perspective, the 7-hour case I talked about was a teaser. It was a testicular sperm biopsy in a man with an unobstructive azoo and a very high FSH hormone level. There were sperm there, but they were very far and few between, and they are grossly abnormal because of the fact that the testicles aren't functioning properly. So again, you're looking for, as an embryologist, the first thing you're doing is assessing what the demographic is, and then what's the best I can get out of this, and working in that mindset constantly. So I think it depends on the type of biopsy that you're taking and why you're taking it, but your urologist is more than capable of giving you the percentage outcome of a successful retrieval. And I think that depends a lot on what they see in your hormone health.
So, like I've said before, I've said it twice now, but it's absolutely amazing what you can tell from just from what happens, hormone levels and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Do you get that from the semen itself? So,
no, you would do a blood test on
the
it.
Blood
on
a guy. So if
a guy comes into me and he's got a low sperm count, we obviously repeat it because I think it's safe to say that, I mean, having now lived through COVID, I could tell you what COVID did for the first round of COVID was awful for sperm health. I had men coming in that were completely azoospermic from horrendous COVID infections, and then it came back. So we know, and it got better because obviously COVID mutated and now we're all living with it, but that's what happened. So certain infections and certain illnesses can make sperm counts drastically reduced. So I think if you're sitting in front of a guy or a couple for the first time with a really low sperm count, I think it's completely negligent to say this is your outcome. You have to reassess that sperm count. You have to look at the medical history. You have to ask, have you been ill? Has there been any infections? Did you have any testicle trauma? You know, there's so many things that we need to find out before we can diagnose someone categorically. This is your sperm count. You definitely need to repeat it in a couple of months.
Yeah.
If you've got the luxury of that time. Obviously some people don't because of reproductive female age. But yeah, so there are lots of reasons, but if you do have a man that's been diagnosed with a low sperm count, the first thing I'm going to do is send him off to a specialist and make sure that they then do the blood tests that allow us to find out if there is a causative factor or if it is something that's developed. So sometimes you can be, I'm sure you've talked about this before, but things like undescended testes, that's not genetic, that's causative. It's something that's happened to you. So there's very different rules, I think, around that. If you either are born with a problem that has led to you having a low sperm count, or it's been caused by something that's happened in your life. Mumps is a classic example. Kids with mumps.
That was what I had. Well, I was 22.
You're really late, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and mumps. And I had a varicocele as well, whether it was one or the other. No one could ever really tell. And essentially, I was able to move past it because the result was going to be the same. So it didn't matter. I didn't need to pin it on something. But the urologist typically on all of my paperwork would say the mumps.
Mumps or colitis, yeah. So it depends where it affects all of those things. Yeah. So like I said, the responsibility that I think we have is as reproductive professionals is to always look at the context and look at the bigger picture and then advise accordingly. But there is no way that a man with a really low sperm count should not be seen by a urologist, because that's not what we are. We're a fertility clinic. We are fertility specialists. I know how to make embryos, but I am not a male fertility expert, and there are people that are very good at that to understand that better.
So I find that really refreshing to hear, in terms of, you know, you give a sample, and we need to be looking at why that sample is like it is. And given what's known now in terms of lifestyle changes, I mean, that's what happened to me. It came down to alcohol and lifestyle had a real impact on my sperm health. And by getting rid of certain things, I saw real improvements in the quality of my sperm, which ultimately led to positive outcome for me, but it took a lot of figuring out that, you know, those first two cycles that I went through, that wasn't done. I just kind of gave my samples, carried on with my normal life. And it wasn't until I kind of decided to make that decision myself and just kind of stopped for my mental health, but also my physical health. And it took about 18 months, which you said, like, not everyone has that time.
No.
But we decided to take that time and it was massively beneficial for me. So, it's really refreshing to hear that. No, coming from.
Well, if you get me on my next drum, I want to get into schools. So that's my next. I'm banging my next drum is to try and get into sixth forms and schools and universities to try and explain to people that actually sperm takes 70. What does Alan Pacey say? 78 days to be created from what we call a germ cell, and eggs are about 110. So yes, the way you're living and what you're putting into your body is ultimately what you're going to get out in 78 days.
Yeah.
So I actually really want to get, and I don't think anyone's, you've never had that conversation. The kids today are still not having that conversation. So you can buy vapes off the shelf like they're sweets, which are the most damaging things for sperm health. So my next big drum is, I'm going to get into sixth forms and universities and start educating on, you have a, if your reproductive health is in your hands, it is 100% in your hands to a certain extent. Obviously, if there's something else going on, then we can't control everything. But in your situation, Kieran, there are people that if you give them the right information and they have the time, they don't need IVF at all. They can actually go away and, so IVF and ICSI are incredibly valuable tools. But are we overusing them? Most likely, because we're just not educating properly.
Yeah, it's almost that kind of, this is the solution. We're not looking at the problem, what's causing it.
Yeah.
And I do think that we're kind of heading in that right direction. People are starting to ask, especially around the increase in male fertility. Over the last few years, there's been massive developments there. It's still nowhere near where it needs to be, but it's picking up traction, isn't it?
So much more engagement from men asking me what they can do to help this process. And that is something I've seen. It is exponential at the moment. And it comes down to people like you and us talking about this, because I used to sit in rooms with couples and the man did not speak. I now sit in rooms with a couple and the man is like, what can I do? What can I do to change this? What's on me? Which bit of this can I change? How can I help? And that that's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, that's excellent. And it's great to hear that you're seeing it from a practitioner point of view. And we're certainly getting contacted by more men now as well, which is brilliant. And we share your passion and vision for getting to the younger audience. And actually, there's been discussions of us starting a TikTok account to get some of our content on there.
Excellent.
Yes, we are. Our line is in the sand. We will not be dancing. We won't be pointing at words and captions, but we understand.
Are you sure? Because it would be very good. I think it would go down very well.
I'm 41, Emma. We have to draw the line at somewhere. I think the only time I do dance at all is after a lot of wine at a wedding. So we will see. But maybe never say never. But no, it's important to reach that audience who can and will make a huge difference to their fertility health. Yeah, that's perhaps something that we could discuss further. But I want to come on to, you mentioned kind of egg collection and what you classify as your day zero.
Mm-hmm.
Could you take me through what you're then doing as an embryologist from then onwards, and again, because it's a whole new world to anyone that finds themselves in that, and new words like, we all knew sperm and eggs before, but new words like embryos and blastocysts, like, please let us know what happens.
So sperm and egg is day zero. Once they come together and you get what's called fertilization, what you end up seeing under a camera or under a microscope, depending on what clinic you're in. Like I said, all my embryos are under cameras from day one at the very last stage, which allows us to not open the incubators and it allows us to see. So I'm a massive advocate also for embryos, and we'll get onto it, but embryo grade is important, but actually the journey is more important because it allows you to see the A to B and how they got there. And that actually correlates really, really highly with outcome of pregnancy when you put embryos back. So we're looking under the cameras on day one for fertilization, which allows us to see two nucleuses, one from sperm, one from egg. And they are now they are called zygotes or embryos. On day one, we then allow in my clinic to all embryos grow out to what's called the blastocyst stage, which is the stage an embryo reaches predominantly directly before it is able to implant into the lining of a womb. I talk a lot in my embryology page about the funnel. So we talk about it as a reverse pyramid. So you start at the top of the funnel with your eggs, then eggs to mature eggs, it drops down a little bit, then mature eggs to fertilized eggs or embryos, it drops a little bit more. And then between fertilized embryos and blastocyst formation, you go into a reversed funnel. You just go into a pyramid. And it depends on what is causing the infertility a lot of the time. It depends on the quality of the eggs and the sperm you've been able to get together and all those numbers. But ultimately, you will end up with a group of embryos at the bottom, hopefully. Some people don't. And they are the embryos that have basically self-selected themselves to being viable for transfer and pregnancy. I think it needs to be said that not all embryos are ever meant to make, not every embryo is meant to make a blastocyst ultimately. Otherwise, you wouldn't, I think the misconception is that when you're trying to conceive naturally, that it's fertilization that's not happening. It probably is, because that's actually quite easy for eggs and sperm. It's the growth, it's the conversation, it's the communication, it's the implantation. So we go from day one, we then track embryos under the camera every day just to make sure they're okay. And we're watching them grow. Each cell should give you another cell. So it should be a single cell to a two cell to four cell to eight, eight to 16, 16 to 32. And then we stop counting, because you just can't after that. There's so many of them. And then we start to look at the entity itself. So what will happen is some embryos will do unusual divisions early on. You can get something called a direct 1-3 cleavage, which is actually embryo fatal. It can happen at the day one stage. So you get a single cell that forms into three cells. We're looking for all these abnormalities to try and determine whether this embryo is viable at the end of the day. And for embryologists, what we're ultimately trying to do is help you get pregnant, number one, absolutely. But secondly, we also want you to have this thought process of reproductive future protection as well. We don't ever want you to be sat. So imagine for me, if I'm sat in front of a woman that's 38 and I've managed to get her potentially one embryo that will work for her to get pregnant now. If she ever wants any more children, she's going to come back to me 2 years later and she's going to be 40. So I need to have the conversation about egg health now, egg age. Egg age fundamentally is everything when you're talking about whether or not fertility treatment works. We can get everyone in a really good place, but we cannot fight age. We cannot change genetics, which is what you said earlier, Kieran, about you had the 18 months, but not everyone has that because they're already at that age where we are really struggling against maternal age. So in a lab, we're constantly watching these embryos grow. Like I said, then we get to sort of day four or five, and we're looking for embryos that are forming into blastocysts. Now, a blastocyst is an entity that has two cell lines. One of the cell lines makes the placenta, and the one other cell line makes the fetus. And it's at that stage we start to grade them. We can biopsy them at that stage. We can freeze them and we can transfer them. But by the end of day six or seven, there is no more support that we can give them in the lab. They need a blood supply, they need to be transferred, or they need to be in the freezer. So that's our end point for embryos in the lab. So to run a scenario, you might have 12 eggs, maybe eight fertilized. And from those eight, I'd expect three or four to be able to be capable of making blastocysts. What day they make that blastocyst stage on is really important. Day five embryos are far more compatible and comparable with pregnancy outcome than day six. Day six and day seven, the longer an embryo takes to get there, the more likely there is an error in its blueprint. And when I talk about its blueprint, I talk about either the sperm health that's adding to its blueprint or the egg genetics, which is to do with maternal age. And all of those things we can test for. But yeah, so that's what we do daily. We're looking after these embryos. We're trying to assess what's happening. And obviously, if you have an egg collection Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, imagine we've got a week of people having them on different days. Everyone is on a different day in the lab throughout the whole week. So we've got like a running list of Mrs. Bloggs is on day five and she is having a transfer today. Mrs. Smith is on day three. she needs a phone call with an update. So it's quite dynamic.
We want to tell you about Imperil, the unique supplement for conception, which is recommended by fertility specialists for both men and women. We know that good nutrition is really important for fertility, but we are also aware that it's practically impossible to maintain a diet that is perfectly balanced, especially for conception. Choosing the right supplement can be confusing. Many multivitamins contain strong antioxidants, which can actually damage sperm quality. Imperil is made from activated micronutrients that help every cell within the human body, from the biggest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These micronutrients have been clinically proven to significantly improve live birth rates for men and women who have previously been struggling to get pregnant. You can find out more and hear from couples who have used Imperil by visiting fertilityfamily.co.uk. If you decide this is for you, there's a 10% discount just for our listeners. So make a note of the code MF10. That's MF10.
That is so interesting. And I very clearly remember the phone call from the embryologists after the day after the egg collection to let us know how many had made it overnight, and then kind of the regular contact then to see how they were going from there. How do you find that that direct contact and with the patient?
That has changed massively over the years, actually. And I think a lot to do, again, comes back to what we're doing. So we tend to do something where we prepare our patients with an embryology consultation before we bring them into treatment. I actually think that week that you're in treatment can be one of the most horrible anxiety-ridden weeks ever. You've handed over everything and it's out of your control. And if you've never met the people that you're dealing with, it must be very scary. So we actually prepare our patients with a half an hour conversation with what's going to happen. And we ask them, when do you want to receive phone calls? Because remember, I can't change the middle bit. And actually embryos can do, I've stopped trying to second guess them after this long. I used to thought I had it all, like I could figure them out. I haven't got a clue what they're doing. Because they do, you think they're doing this and then they go and do this and then they form into the most beautiful entities, or they're going really well and then they stop. So actually me talking to you between fertilization and day five is very vague, and I wonder how much it adds. I kind of like to prepare people for what's going to happen in those 5 days, give them some really significant statistics so they've got some sort of management of expectation. But almost I like you to take a break, because it is out of your hands. We've got it, we've got eyes on all the time. But if you need the touch base, if you need us, we're at the end of the phone. But there is an element there that actually telling, what I have learned from years of embryology is telling a patient that she's got 8 fantastic embryos on day 3 and then phoning on day 5 and telling her she's got nothing is actually worse than not having said anything at all. Do you see what I mean? Because it's that crushing drop down.
Yeah.
So we know that embryos can develop really beautifully up to day 3, day 4, driven by the egg to a certain extent, almost like on autopilot. And then it takes over its own genetic control. And whether that's coming from the sperm or the egg age, there can be a massive failure between day 3 and day 5 because of multiple reasons, which I haven't got time to go into. But I think actually what the kindest thing I can do is manage expectations before you start and then give you outcomes at the end of where we're at on day 5. So I tend to phone people day 1 and day 5.
Yeah,
unless someone needs to speak to me. So yeah.
I love that. That what you're implementing is brilliant, and I think it will reduce that kind of unknown element a lot. And like you said, you know, just receiving a phone call at some point can have its own challenges as well. And yeah, it's
context as well. I mean, I know when someone needs more, and that's fine. Like there's no right or wrong about this, but I also have got an incredible level of experience with what this does to people's. I had my own very personal difficult journey to parenthood. And so I come from it from a different perspective now of the anxiety of what that must be like to live in that week. And I just would prefer that I was able to give solid answers and be really sure about what I'm telling someone than second guessing it, because that's all we're doing in the middle. We are playing a guessing game to a certain extent. We are watching something grow under a camera that you're not meant to watch grow. And it's like there's so many unknowns. And like I said, I'm not naive enough to know that I do not know everything. Mm. I don't yet. And there's I get surprised daily by things even now that I go, oh, well, that was unexpected. And it's lovely when that happens and you get an embryo where you weren't expecting one, or, you know. So I would prefer to just be able to be really clear with patients. I think patients deserve better. I think they deserve facts, and I don't think they deserve to be on an emotional roller coaster. If fertility treatment is an emotional roller coaster, let's not make it any worse.
I think it's that concept of I distinctly remember that during that 5-day period, you're just looking for that little bit of control that you can never have. Like, you can't control what that embryo does. And you know, we've had positives, but we've also had the negatives where you get that good phone call or it's all going well, and then it goes wrong. So I can completely...
It's hard.
Yeah, it's incredibly hard. It's incredibly... Because I think as a man as well, like I just bottled it up because my wife, Jen, she needed that emotional support then. In my head, I was like, right, I've got to take care of her. Because so much was kind of pinned on that phone call or those phone calls going through. So it definitely sounds...
Yeah, as a couple, if you know when to expect them,
yeah,
and you know that there's not going to be this or that, and we have made that arrangement beforehand, I think you can manage things better. I definitely see a better mental health in my patients from being in this method than I have done before.
Yeah, it sounds... Yeah, it's something that I think, if knowing what I know now, I would take that option. Like, just let me know when, on certain days.
But all you need is someone to explain that to you.
Yeah.
All you need is someone to say, this is what I'm capable of doing as an embryologist, and this is what I can't do. And I don't have a crystal ball. I wish I did. I wish I did, because if I could take some of this away, I would love to.
Yeah.
But I don't. So what I can do is be kind and tell you that and be really honest. And so we do these consultations that are quite bespoke and personal, and we talk to you about your own circumstances. And we base a lot on that, on age and fertility needs and all of that, because we kind of know, based on all those demographics and factors, what we're expecting at the end. We know that you're going to get, we know you're not going to get 20 eggs. We know you're going to get 5. So I think you can sort of manage things better by speaking to patients on a one-to-one basis rather than trying to put everyone into the same... Like patient information. Patient information is great. I think it's brilliant, but I think there has to be some bespoke context to it. Otherwise, the people are different.
Yeah. It's like every story is different, isn't it? Like me and Sean have the same outcomes, but our story is very, very different. But we experience the same things, the same emotions, and the same at some point, you know, but completely different stories.
Yeah. Especially the sperm sample story is very different. Kieran left the lid on once, but let's not go over that one again.
Really, you know, I wasn't...
not one I've not heard before.
Well, that's the thing, you know, you said it, Emma, is that you, and that is really crucial. There's nothing you haven't heard, so let's take out the embarrassment.
Never be scared. I could share some stories that you wouldn't have heard.
Well, I think that definitely calls for a follow-up session, a follow-up recording of, like, yeah, that those stories. It sounds like they need to be heard.
Oh, they do. They do. I need to write them down, because some of them, it's about bringing humor into this as well, right? Because this is bloody hard.
Yeah.
And there has to be some element where we all sit down and say, you know, it is hard. It is, but we're all doing the very best we can, and you've still got to have a giggle in life. Otherwise,
absolutely,
it is too hard, right?
It's one of our main objectives, isn't it, mate? Because we sit there and we can talk from the other side now, and we know how difficult it is. But at the end of the day, it's life, and you've got to kind of sometimes you take it on the chin and you get on and you get back on your feet and. But you can chuckle and try and reflect when you're done or on the process through. But it can be incredibly difficult.
I'll give you one that I think will entertain your listeners, and it is something that stayed with me about someone that really understood the stress he was under and tried to find a little bit of humour in it. And he walked into the room and he looked absolutely petrified. And I said to him, "You're right." For anyone that knows me, I literally have no filter. So it's like, I'm a bit like, "You all right? Like, And he was like, looking around, looked like he'd been rabbit caught in the headlights. And he went, well, where are the lap dancers? And I went, oh, shit. I said, it's Wednesday. They don't work on Wednesdays. So he went, my fucking wife, she can't get anything right. He goes, all right, I'll see what I can do. And it stayed with me because it was his way of coping with it. Yeah. And it was a bit of banter and it was a bit of fun. And I'll never forget that.
I love it.
If you can go in with that mindset. He made my day. I thought that was brilliant.
Brilliant. So. That is, to have that kind of composure to crack a joke in that situation, hats off brilliant. To that fella.
Hats off, yeah.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Well, you know, that feels like such a great place to leave this today.
yeah, I didn't think we'd end up just after the lap dancers today, we were going to finish it.
That's definitely going in the show notes. Here we talk about sperm, embryology and lap dances. But, Emma, our guiding principle has always been to be what we needed when we were going through it. And we needed this. And we cannot thank you enough for coming on and sharing your expertise, your knowledge. So honestly, thank you.
And I think the world is a much better place because of you guys right now, because the feedback I'm getting is massive. And you are changing my day today. So I thank you for opening a conversation that is so desperately needs opening. So thank you, because I'm definitely seeing a huge impact on male mental health going through fertility treatment with people like you behind them.
Thank you. It means a lot to us.
Yeah, it means a lot. Thank you, Emma.
If there's anything that we haven't asked you today that people would like to, how is best to contact you?
Emma the embryologist, I do a lot on there, like I said, breaking it down, doing some embryology. People are more than welcome to DM me on there. I do as much as possible try and get back to people with, if it's a quick question, I can normally answer it. If it's simple, if I don't know the answer, I will always tell you I don't know the answer. Like I said to you earlier, I stay in my lane. Absolutely. If anyone wants to do what does want anything or any advice, then jump in there.
And that's on Instagram. Brilliant. Yeah. TikTok coming soon, dancing.
Well, I'm 44, so sure, if you're not doing it at 41, then I'm...
So it's all down to me then, at 30.
Yeah, he's the youngster.
That's it, Kieran. You start and we'll be your backing dancers. How does that sound?
His age still begins with a 3, so yeah, he's the dancer here.
Doesn't look like it.
Amazing. Well, thank you. Thank you. And thanks to our listeners for, as always, supporting us. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Emma. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.